Hello and welcome to the Napoleonic Quarterly. My name is Bernie Campbell. It's my pleasure to be here this episode with our very special guest, Louis Sarkozy, who is an author who has written a book about Napoleon and his books and his library, which sounds very interesting. I took a look at the information about it coming out soon, and he's here to talk with us about his book and to talk with us about his perspective on the Napoleonic period. We're very honored to have Mr. Sarkozy here today because we have talked in the past behind the scenes about the fact that we tend to have a lot of English language experts on the Napoleonic period. So it's very nice to have someone who will bring us a little bit of a French perspective today. So welcome to the show today, Mr. Sarkozy. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, we are very excited to have you come in today and talk about your book. Could you give us a little bit of information to get us started this morning, a little bit of information about the book you've written and what it's all about and when we can expect to see it?
Sure, yeah. Well, thanks for asking. The book is set to be released on May 30th in the UK. It is now available on UK Amazon under the title Napoleon's Library, The Emperor, His Books, and Their Influence on the Napoleonic Era. It will be followed by an American publication in August with Casemate Publishing. And after that, in October of 2025, I was just told it is set to be translated and published in my native France. It was written in English. I mean, I'm happy to represent the French perspective here, but I must admit to you and your listeners, I speak and write much better in English than I do in my native French. A bit of an irony, but I've spent most of my adult life studying and writing in the United States. So the book is, at least attempts to be, a story of Napoleon's life through the books that he read and the writers who influenced him. So I knew, as you must and as many of your listeners must, that Napoleon Bonaparte was a gargantuan reader. Every biography of his mentions his love and penchant for books. But I really had no idea just how much the books that he read influenced him in as many ways as one can think. So both as a man personally, as a father and as a husband, but also how it influenced him as a politician, how it influenced him as a military leader and a general, as a reformer, and also as a theorist of music, of tragedy, of theater. So it's really all encompassing. So the book starts out, obviously, when he's young. It follows a chronological pattern throughout his life. And it really begins when he gets to France, when he starts studying at Brienne-le-Château, the military academy, because that's when, at least I argue, books started to play a major role in his life. Before then, we have some sources, including his mother, who tell us that he was a very gargantuan reader already back in Corsica. You know, she says all the other boys his age were playing in the courtyard of the Casa Buonaparte, and he was on the third floor in the attic, reading especially history books. But when he gets to France, there's sort of a perfect storm, and books provide a perfect escape. So he is very proud to be Corsican when he gets to France. He has a very strong Corsican accent. He doesn't like the French very much. In fact, he hates them. And so he is the butt of remarks by his aristocratic peers. Today, we would call that bullying. There's also rumors that his mother was the product of his mother's infidelity with the Comte de Marbeuf, the French governor of Corsica. And his skin tone was a bit different than the other French kids there. People at the time called it an olive tone or an olive skin tone. And so this perfect storm where he's a proud Corsican patriot, he has a different skin color, he's the butt of remarks about his mom. And so he's bullied and somewhat isolated apart from a few friends. And he really falls into reading to protect himself from that. And it goes even so far as, for example, the kids at Brienne were each allotted a little plot of land to plant vegetation, to teach him the rudiments of agriculture. And he planted his almost entirely with foliage as to create a solitary habitat he could isolate himself in to read. So he even tries to become the school librarian, and he really starts to read specifically history. It's when he first discovers an author that will stay with him for the rest of his life, which is Plutarch and Plutarch's Lives. I mean, today, still very famous, but back then it was an absolute mainstay on any educated person's reading list. And it's where he discovers the two men that are going to be his lifelong heroes, Julius Caesar and Alexander the Great. He also discovers a whole host of classical authors, and I would say for the first third of his life, primarily his readings will be historical. So then he moves away from Brienne. He has read a lot of history, but he is very deficient in other aspects of his education. He gets to the École Militaire of Paris, already a much more serious military institution than Brienne was. In fact, there's much to be said about the educational shortcomings of Brienne. So he gets to the École Militaire, and he first starts to study legitimate strategic treatises. And this is a subject that I'm very surprised was not dealt with more. I mean, because Napoleon revolutionized the strategy and tactics and was very much a trendsetter. And so I thought it very bizarre that more people had not looked at what were the first strategic treatises that he had read when he was a teenager. And it turns out that when you read the stuff he had read, including most famously the Traité Stratégique of Jacques-Antoine Hippolyte de Guibert, you find in Guibert a lot of the insights and a lot of the strategic innovations that would later characterize the Napoleonic innovations. So, for example, the corps system, world famous corps system that he invented and revolutionized. You find a lot of the tenets of the corps system in Guibert, the importance of having fast, free-flowing armies that forge on the move rather than carrying heavily burdened supply trains, for example. The importance of having smaller armies, but more highly trained ones, rather than big, large, cumbersome groupings. The importance of having, and this was Guibert's great insight, the importance of having national armies made up of citizens and not just mercenaries and aristocrats. Something that was, I mean, almost eerily true. I mean, within 10 years of Guibert's death, the world, Europe, would essentially turn out to be populated by only national armies, or at least not at first, but the trend was very much started. So it's very interesting to see what Napoleon read on the military side of things because of the reasons I've just laid out. And then begins another of his literary infatuations when he starts to be a young man. He's no longer a kid. He's posted at various garrison jobs around France in the years, in the boring years and the slow years before the start of the revolutions. He deals with two or three riots now and then, but he's very bored and he's sort of questioning his life choices, and he attempts to become a writer. And he becomes fascinated with Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the philosophe, the string of Enlightenment thinkers, which would have such an impact on the upcoming revolution. And that's when Napoleon starts to write. It's when you can see in his writings just how much he had read Rousseau, because he plagiarizes Rousseau in almost everything he writes. He enters an essay contest, etc. So then begins another phase of his life.
And you know what they say about good writers. Good writers borrow from other writers. Great writers steal from them outright.
that's correct. Although I'm afraid to say that Napoleon was not a great writer. So when you look at his corpus, he produced some stuff of quality, but most of it is very, very mediocre. Very plagiarized, not original. He has two or three interesting things that we can talk about if you want, but just to speed up my resume a little bit, I will not go into them now. And then, of course, there is the Siege of Toulon and the Vendémiaire Revolt, and then that's when his star begins to shoot up, and he very much sets down the pen and picks up the sword, and he knows his life will not be one of attempting to become a writer, a life of rumination and thinking. It will be a life of action and a military life. And then he sort of completely turns away from the philosophy. He stops to read Rousseau. In fact, he completely divorces from him and he calls him crazy. I mean, it's a complete turnaround on the philosophe. And then my book also talks about in depth the Egyptian expedition, because it's so obvious his love of literature and culture and the arts within the context of that expedition. I mean, if it was another general who had headed that expedition, if it was Menou or somebody else, you would not have brought along, you know, 200 savants, cartographers, botanists, antiquarians, historians, you know, proto-archaeologists. I mean, he brings all these people along because his hero Alexander had brought along 200 philosophers and because he loved culture. So I talk about that in the book. And then after that, it's, of course, the rise to power, the consulate and the empire. And then my book covers the great palatial libraries that he built. and the great dedicated staff of librarians and bibliographers that he organized, headed by fascinating people, first Ripo and then a guy called Barbier, who was a genius in his own right, bibliographical genius, organizing the libraries, acquiring new books, making sure that whatever palace Napoleon is staying at always well-stocked with books, etc. The First French Empire was an empire of books, another historian has called it. I mean, they have tremendous ambitions. At some point, Napoleon gives an order to acquire for his palatial libraries a copy of every book published in Europe in its original language and translated into French, the Danish books, the Swedish books, the English books, the Spanish books, the Italian books. It's absolutely crazy ambition. These libraries grow to over 60,000 volumes. And so I trace that story. And then, of course, I cover the fall for the first exile in Elba. And it's the first time since his youth that Napoleon now starts to have trouble acquiring books, which prompted a very severe depression. The short return, the 100 days, the flight of the eagle, as we called it in France. And then finally, the final exile in St. Helena and the slow descent into depression, disease, and death, which, of course, is correlated with a complete dearth of books. He has huge trouble acquiring books on St. Helena. In fact, I argue it's probably the main reason for the deterioration of his relationship with the island's governor, Sir Hudson Lowe, is because Lowe censored so many books and you know, did not honor the request for books that the emperor and his entourage were making. And then there's some final writings also on St. Helena. He picks up the pen again now that, you know, he lost everything and he has nothing else to do. And then, you know, I go up to the last chapter, which is The Dusk of a Reader. And it's the final readings, the final thoughts, the final scribblings, and then his death. And a very quick note also on the world-famous Memorial of St. Helena, one of the bestsellers of the 19th century, because, of course, in a life so literary, it had to be a book which popularized Napoleon, which really cemented his legacy and birthed his legend. Just as it was in Egypt, a book, La Description de l'Égypte, which popularized the expedition and, you know, made Egypt so fashionable for over a century, you know, kickstarting what is now called Egyptomania, the obsession with all things Egyptian. So that's the story I try to tell. It's a story of his life through books, not only that influenced him, but also the books he either he had written or he sponsored that did so much to cement his legend.
All right, that sounds really fascinating. I can speak to the enduring call of Egypt. I have a 12-year-old in the house who is very much an aspiring Egyptologist at the moment. You know, he wants to go to school to be an archaeologist, and Egypt is very high on his list of places to go. So I can speak to kind of the enduring legacy of that through Napoleon's campaigns in Egypt and the sparking that Egypt mania, as you talked about. Speaking of books, and this is a question that I sort of circulated that I was going to be conducting this interview with among the other members of the podcast to try and troll for some ideas. One of the things that came up was this question of censorship, because, you know, one of the things we learn about in the First Empire is that there was a lot of censorship, you know, particularly of newspapers and the press by Napoleon, his administration, to kind of silence critics. And what role, what impact does that have on books and literature? You spoke about the idea that Napoleon wants to gather a copy of every book published in Europe and a French translation. You know, obviously there are rules for emperors and there are rules for everybody else, but I can only imagine that there were probably books being published in Europe at the time of his empire that perhaps Napoleon didn't really want in wider circulation in his empire during this time period. So can you kind of speak to that idea of censorship versus the desire for knowledge and information and how that played out in the context of the empire?
Of course, it's such a good question. And of course, I deal with it at length in my book, The Question of Censorship. And it's one of the things that is incomprehensible to me. This is one of the great paradoxes of the book and of his life, is that this man who was by far the most literary ruler, the greatest lover of books on a throne in the history of mankind, created and instituted and enforced the most ghastly regime of censorship possible. I mean, and this is it's one thing in the beginning of the reign, they do institute censorship, but in the beginning of the reign, at least, you can argue it's necessary because we had just come out of 10 years of revolution and counter-revolution. The press had been completely unmuzzled for a decade. And I mean, the consequences have been horrible. You would have the famous appel au meurtre. You'd have people executed and guillotined just because their name appeared in a newspaper. So you can argue that in the beginning of the reign, it's a somewhat moderate censorship, very comparable to what other European courts had in place, including in England. But as the years go on, the Napoleonic censorship gets worse and worse. Until at the end of the reign, it's almost like it's satire. I mean, no play is authorized to be shown unless it gives endless praise to the emperor and the regime. No book without a dedication is authorized to be published. He manages to alienate all the great authors of his age. So he alienates Madame de Stael, a genius author, who was so enamored with him in the beginning, and he exiles her, he forbids her books from being published. In all my research, I still haven't figured out why. I mean, he was a guy with such charisma and charm. If he really wanted to seduce her and turn her into an ally, he really could have. He alienates Chateaubriand, probably the greatest French author of the age. He alienates Benjamin Constant, who comes back, but only at the very end and when it's way too late. So you have this great paradox. How come? How is it possible that a man who loved literature so much instituted this terrible regime of censorship? And I think the answer is partly because he loved books, he needed books, he used books in all the facets of his life and his reign and his military campaigns. But his one true obsession was politics and the control of public opinion. And he had a very sort of revolutionary outlook on the impact of books. So if a book for him had a 1% chance of negatively influencing public opinion, it had to be taken out. I mean, this is a man who lived firsthand through all of the turmoils and all the murders and the catastrophes of the French Revolution. And throughout that generation, much in the same way you have with the generation who was the rulers during World War II, They were obsessed with never having a World War I again. I mean, it marked their minds. It's what Chamberlain, Peace in Our Time. They were just so scarred by that experience. I think it's the same thing with Napoleon. I think they're so scarred with the tremendous eruption of the French Revolution that they just sort of go overboard with censorship. It's a great mistake by him, obviously. He completely muzzles the country's literary and theatrical productions. And at the end, of course, when he comes back in 1815, he knows he needs political allies, so he declares a free press, and then that kicks out a complete revival of French letters that will last for the next 15 or 20 years. So it's a great paradox. It's a great shame. It's very, very difficult to understand as somebody who has studied the subject, but it's a fascinating one nonetheless.
Yeah. That's a really good point about sort of this reaction. I actually talk about this in some of my classes. We talk about the period between World War I and World War II. We just covered that off. We do a chronological approach. It's April, so this is World War II. We just covered that off in my classes at school about that time period between World War I and World War II, where that generation was just so much wanting to avoid what happened in World War I that they're willing to do anything to prevent it. So it does kind of necessitate a reevaluation of some of those folks and their attitudes. And I can kind of see that with the French Revolution at the beginning, where you're trying to prevent, another cataclysm like that from happening and therefore muzzling the press. But it does create this really great contradiction between someone, particularly and as you talked about earlier, someone who read the philosophes, read Rousseau, and read some of those other folks who talked so much about open ideas and open mind, to then turn around and become this great censor, to kind of muzzle so much public opinion. Do you think that speaks to kind of maybe this is a little bit beyond our scope, but do you think that kind of speaks to that insecurity that, that was probably brought on in his childhood about the bullying and being targeted as a young man, trying to prevent that later, sort of thin skin almost, to a certain degree, not really willing to tolerate the kind of criticism. He's now in a position where he says, no, I don't need to tolerate that. You can just shut up.
you're so right when it comes to the insecurity. It's not only personal insecurity, although he was filled with that. And we can talk about that. I mean, he's a Freudian dream case in many ways because he's so full of complexes. But the insecurity of his dynasty, and this is something that obsesses him, the quest for legitimacy. He said ad nauseum, you know, the Bourbons, they have 1,000 years. The Habsburgs, they have that's their legitimacy. They can lose 15 wars and they'll still be fine. I cannot, right? I'm an upstart. Right? I came from nothing. This is why he constantly seeks the great battle, the great victory, because he's convinced that this is what grants him legitimacy, victory and efficiency in governance. So when he sees a problematic publication, he immediately feels way more threatened than a king from the Bourbon family would, because he doesn't have that legitimacy. Whether he's right is another question altogether. He may very well could have been wrong. He may very well could have been way too insecure about his legitimacy, but that's what he believes. He thinks he doesn't have the same leeway as some of these other aristocratic families because he comes from very low and unremarkable nobility. And so when he sees one problematic article or one problematic play, he says, I immediately have to shut it down because this is a mortal threat to me because I can't tolerate that. I mean, I simply don't have the bandwidth to tolerate that. My dynasty is too fragile. He says, maybe we give it, you know, 50, 60, 70 years and my grandkids will be able to tolerate that, but I simply can't.
That's an interesting point. You know, I do think there's, to a certain extent, you know, in some of my studies in the reading, I think that he underestimates his staying power to a great degree. I think that, you know, from what I've read and what I've, you know, studied, the European royal houses were probably far more forgiving, at least maybe not forgiving, but pragmatic than he gives them credit for in wanting to just deal with him. You know, certainly the Habsburgs may have dealt with him more willingly than he would believe, you know, especially given their rivalry in the long term with the Bourbons. They would have
been
like...
The Habsburgs is a bit different, I would argue, because they, and this my friend Arthur Chevalier, who's a great French historian and expert on this question, but makes this really great point, is that the Habsburgs are the prototypical opposites of the Napoleonic experiment. I mean, the Habsburg is this sort of conglomerate polyglot empire which relies on one thing, and that is the antique legitimacy of the crown. It's not nationality. It's not efficiency, because they're the most inefficient government in the history of mankind. They have Croats and Italians and Germans and Hungarians. It's no nationality. The only thing they are is conservative royalists. And so the Habsburgs seem to believe that every time Napoleon goes to war, he's going to get overthrown. I mean, they sort of don't believe in the French Revolution to such an extent that Arthur says they still don't believe it today. Today, they're still like, this whole thing will collapse any moment now. There's something impossible for a Habsburg mind to comprehend the French Revolution and its son, who was Napoleon. So I would slightly disagree with the Habsburgs, but certainly they're pragmatic before everything else. And if Napoleon had been less punitive in some of his treatises after his great victories, we very well could have envisioned a very different world in which Napoleonic Empire might have stayed. He obviously committed gross mistakes and was a terrible long-term strategist and diplomat, almost as much as he was a genius as a short-term tactician and military leader. But yeah, no. To go back on the question of censorship, it's one of the fascinating angles of the book, and it's one that also ultimately he wins, you know, because at the end he loses everything. The French population is very tired of him at the end, and it's quite happy to get rid of him because he gets associated with war, and then he gets to St. Helena. He spends 6 years there. He publishes the Memorial of St. Helena, where Las Casas publishes the Memorial of St. Helena, I should say. And it's so successful in rebranding him as the champion of nationalism, the champion of liberalism. It creates Bonapartism, which was the political party that survived and had nothing to do with his reign, but everything to do with the legend, that 20, 30 years later, he's the hero again after his death. So he sort of wages one last battle with posterity using books, using that one book, The Memoir of St. Helena, and is triumphant. So it's really a fascinating, I call it the literary arc of his life, where at the end, he's ultimately successful using the very medium he loved so much, but also strove to contain so much.
We have a saying for that, and we've actually kicked this idea around in the podcast before: losing the war and winning the peace.
Yeah.
You know, and we kind of say that here in America too, with regards to a certain extent, the American Civil War has a similar arc of that, at least until recently. And so that actually brings me to another group of questions that I wanted to ask. You know, I know your primary language to write in is English, and you're more comfortable in that language. But as someone who has spent time in France and grew up French, what is the French view of Napoleon today? You know, and I know that's kind of evolving. I've seen some current events sort of, you know, pieces, you know, about how that view of him is evolving in modern French politic. You know, is we often debate, and I actually assign an essay in some of my classes, Napoleon hero or villain, and I hand out primary sources and they have to, you know, make the argument Napoleon hero or villain. But in France, do they have sort of a similar argument? Is there a view that he's a villain? Is there a view that he's a hero? What's the French perspective, generally speaking, do you find on that question?
Yeah, it's also a fascinating question. And I would say it's twofold. So number one, now he's primarily a child of the right, which is insane because he is the son of the revolution. He was a hero of the left. I mean, he cemented all of the advances of the French Revolution, the collapse of the nobility, equality before the law, religious toleration, efficient secular civil administration and legal reform, all of the products of the left at the time. And now his existence has sort of been completely transformed and he's seen as a right-wing figure, which is completely ahistorical. I mean, the real right-wingers hated him, the legitimists, and the moderate right-wingers, the Orleanists. That was his enemies. I mean, he created a great dynasty based on the encapsulation of the best things about the French Revolution, which were very much left-leaning values. So that's number one. Number two, his legacy is very ambivalent. And this is the great Napoleonic historian Jean Tullard has said, the legend, who really created modern Napoleonic studies and is still alive and kicking, by the way. He's, I think, 94, 95. I went to one of his talks a couple months ago when the movie came out. I mean, amazing, amazing guy. He says it's very important to have new publications every 10 or so years because every new generation sees him within the light of their own issues. So in the 60s, you had the gender issue. Today, it's colonialism and slavery and racism. So we sort of reinvent him. Every time we get a new societal debate, we bring him back up within the context of that debate. And so today, we just had the bicentennial 2 years ago, bicentennial of his death. The president, President Macron, gave 3 years ago, actually gave a speech. Very beautiful speech, I thought, where he says, you know, we commemorate, not celebrate, which I thought was absurd. I don't think actually Macron said that. I think a journalist said that about the speech. Macron said, you know, he's a part of us, which he most definitely is. People now, you know, on pundits and journalists and proto-historians would get on TV network and say, oh, he, you know, how could you celebrate him because he was a racist? He absolutely was not a racist. Complete nonsense. He was a colonialist. Well, I mean, the Egyptian expedition is absolutely a colonial venture. I don't hear much criticisms of the colonialism of the Netherlands. You know, he also conquered European lands. But that's one thing that these people never talk about. It's colonialism in Europe. We love to point out how European powers and Napoleon ventured outside of Europe to conquer, but you know, the conquest of Spain, the conquest of Russia, that's not colonialism. So we view him in those lights. But you know, for every detractor, there is somebody else who comes up and who defends him. And today, and I think as the movie, Ridley Scott's movie, showed, there's more interest in him and his legacy than there probably ever was. And thanks to the new tools, the new informational tool, the great books that have come out in the last 10 or 20 years, the many, many documentaries, the massive size of the bibliography. I mean, there have been more books written about him than any other figure in world history. I mean, I think it's something like a book and a half a day every day since his death in 1821. So it's just, and all of that's accessible now. So his I would say today is considered to be a right-wing figure. I would say it's a very ambivalent legacy, and the left loves to criticize his alleged racism and colonialism and authoritarianism. And he's very much defended, at least mostly, by the right. And that, of course, that is very ironical. Very ironic, I should say, because he was originally a product of his the times left. And he was a product of the revolution, which was an absolutely left-leaning venture. So I hope that answers your question, even though it's a bit long-winded.
No, that's fine. I think it's fascinating as well that you know, you are, you know, obviously he was a product of the revolutionary period, and that is something that did come from the left. But today, you know, because of the right, and in France and elsewhere in Europe and even in the United States, sort of embrasure of, you know, a kind of authoritarianism, you know, a brand of authoritarianism to a certain extent, they see Napoleon as the model. And so, yeah,
which is not people who call him a dictator. This is one of the, I mean, if he's a dictator, then every monarch is a dictator. He was a monarch. Yes, he took power in a military coup. That is absolutely a fact. Do we need to mention all of the list of the English monarchs who won in military civil wars? I mean, do we need to talk about the successive dynasties of Prussia, the most militaristic regime in the history of mankind? I mean, he was not a dictator. He was a monarch, right? And by the way, it was absolutely not a military monarchy or a military dictatorship. The soldiers played absolutely no role in civil governance. No role whatsoever. They were very present because there were many wars, outside wars. But the soldiers had no control over the workings of France, over the civil and the governmental war and the legal workings or judicial workings of France. So he was absolutely not a military dictatorship. He was absolutely not a dictator, by the way. He subjected himself many times to plebiscites. Yes, he fiddled around with the numbers, but we also have the original numbers, and he did collect a crushingly large amount of support in France. So it was a popular monarchy, at least at first. And he has just the same amount of right to be a monarch as all the other heads of state of Europe at the time. Because this is a great thing with Napoleon. He was a warmonger. Okay, out of the 7 Napoleonic Wars, 5 were declared on him and on France. He instituted censorship. Okay, every country in the world at that time had a form of censorship. Like, find me a country in the 1800s, in the 1810s, or the 18 teens, which had an absolutely unbridled and free press. I mean, this is we because he was so successful in many ways in cementing himself in our modern minds that we hold him to a different standard than everybody else. But when you put him back in his context, when you compare him to the other monarchies of Europe, he was an incredibly modern monarch in many ways. I mean, for the colonialists, he gets to Egypt. And this is something I cover quite extensively in the book. He translates the Quran and issues translated versions to his soldiers, telling them to respect the imams and the muftis in the same way that they respected priests and rabbis in Europe. He has the French band and the entire French occupying force celebrate the anniversary of the Prophet. He orchestrates and organizes caravans of pilgrims to Mecca. He publishes declarations where he apparently has renamed himself, thanks to some cooperative imams, as Ali Napoleon, who, and the chief imam of Cairo declares him one of the great grandnephews of the Prophet. I mean, it's hilarious, and it reads like satire. But it's the first Hearts and Mind campaign in modern history, right? I mean, this is not at all the sort of conservative, authoritarian, xenophobic races. No, this is, of course, it was pragmatic. Of course, he wanted to secure Egypt as a French colony. But this is nonetheless tremendously modern. I mean, this is an exceptional strategy to be adopting in the 1790s, right? Today, we still have trouble with the Hearts and Mind campaign. He gave the template for that. So he was in answer to your essay prompt, he was absolutely a hero. And send me any of your students who writes the contrary, and I'm going to give him a crash course.
Okay, well, that sounds good. That sounds good. The elephant in the room, of course, is we've touched on a couple of times, is Ridley Scott's new movie. We had an entire episode where we sort of deconstructed the film to a certain extent. And I know Alex did a mini series where he took the film in about 15 minute chunks, given his restrictions on screen time at the present moment. And the conclusions we came to were it was not the world's best piece of cinema. And that's putting it mildly, to summarize the sayings of some of my colleagues. So I'm interested in what you thought of the film, and where you think it falls on, you know, accuracy, entertainment, you know, the balance between entertainment and accuracy. What are your thoughts on Ridley Scott's film?
I want to give a short preface. I'm a massive fan of Ridley Scott. I thought Kingdom of Heaven was a masterpiece. As any historian of the Crusader States or the 12th and 11th century will tell you, it is absolutely not accurate. That does not make it a bad movie. Quite the contrary, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. I thought Gladiator was great. I thought it was a fantastic movie. I rewatch it often. As any historian of ancient Rome can tell you, it is absolutely inaccurate. I say this why? Because a historical movie does not have to be perfectly accurate to be great.
I enjoyed Inglourious Bastards. It's clearly
amazing.
Not an accurate movie.
Amazing movie. Ridley Scott has quite rightly said, you can make, don't get your history from Hollywood. Watch a documentary, read a book if you want to do history. I'm making movies. I think he's 100% right. But I thought his Napoleon was trash. I thought it was a bad movie. Not because it's inaccurate, and my God, is it inaccurate. I mean, it's fiction. But just because it's a bad movie. Just in terms of cinematography, first of all, what's the deal with this filter that they put on it? Everything's gray. Everything is this bluish, dark gray. The one thing about Napoleonic era battlefields was people were dressed in the most flamboyant colors imaginable. You had purple and gold, the Polish Lancers, you had the red and the green, the deep royal blue. I mean, it was wonderful to see. Everything in the movie is deep blue-gray. I mean, I don't know what the hell that is. I thought the music also was not that great. There were a couple good moments, a couple good revolutionary songs that they threw in, but I thought there was no character development apart from Josephine and Napoleon. In Kingdom of Heaven, Scott has 7 or 8 characters. You grow to love every single one of them, both Muslims and Christians. It's not at all a good guy, bad guy. The whole movie's full of nuance. The great final scene, and it's so touching and subtle. And by the way, it's not obvious. When Salahaddin finally captures Jerusalem at the end, and he stumbles upon the tomb of Baldwin IV, he walks around it out of respect. Right, for the defunct king of Jerusalem, his great enemy. That is incredibly subtle and touching and beautiful, right? There's no such subtlety or character development in Napoleon. Talleyrand, who was an absolute genius, is in like 2 scenes and he's pathetic. Barras, who is pretty much unremarkable, is given, I would say, the third role. But then again, I mean, he just gives orders 2 or 3 times. You barely even see him. And there's nobody else. There's no Murat, there's no military figures, really. No Murat, who was the most flamboyant and charismatic and brave cavalry general in existence, who was so brave and so daring that during the Russian campaigns, the Cossacks, the Russian cavalrymen, yelled out cries in his honor and tried to capture him alive. I mean, imagine that. Imagine what would happen today if something like that happened. It would be like having an American soldier so renowned for his valor and bravery that the Taliban in Afghanistan would yell out cries in his honor, praising him and try to capture him alive to honor. I mean, it's unimaginable today, right? Nothing of that. I thought the battle scenes in the movie were also very disappointing. Everybody was waiting for the battle scenes. Of course, they're completely inaccurate, but again, that's a secondary point. No great epic cavalry charges. I mean, it's a mob at Austerlitz, completely disorganized. At Waterloo or Borodino, it's like it's like 30 guys on horses running around. I mean, I thought it was a very disappointing portrayal of Napoleonic battles. I thought it portrayed nothing of the tactics, nothing of the epicness. I mean, we have sources that tell us that when they witnessed a cavalry charge, people had heart attacks of fear. I mean, it was the most awe-inspiring and terrifying sight. People felt the ground shake for miles. I didn't get any of that epicness in Scott's portrayal. So I thought it was very disappointing and incredibly inaccurate as I've said, because a movie can be great, then it doesn't have to be inaccurate. But if it sucks, it better be accurate.
that was essentially the conclusion we came to. It's like, historians can forgive a bad, historically inaccurate movie if it's really good, but this wasn't a good movie, so we're going to take it apart.
Exactly. And then, yeah, the inaccuracy, I mean, this obsession with Josephine. Listen, you can make a movie about their relationship. It's a great angle. I think it's worthy of being made. They had a fascinating relationship, much more interesting than legend hasn't. But this idea that he came back from Egypt because he was afraid of her infidelity, that he comes back from Elba because of her, is absolute nonsense. I mean, it's not understanding who the guy was at all. His great passion, as I said, was politics. And when there was political opportunity, when there was political gain, everything became subordinate to that. And of course, finally, I thought Phoenix played him very badly. Napoleon was a Mediterranean. He was a guy with electrifying charisma, incredible amounts of energy, wore his emotions on his sleeve, could be incredibly red-blooded. He's in Rome one day and there's an Italian delegation that comes to visit him and he throws a stool at them as they enter because he was mad. I mean, famously, he stomps on his hat in 1813 with Metternich. This was a guy whose emotions sort of overpowered him at times. We didn't see any of that in the movie. I think Phoenix cries in his handkerchief twice, and that's the extent of the emotional spectrum that we're subjected to. I mean, so I thought it was very, very disappointing. In fact, Phoenix himself said he didn't know how to play Napoleon when he got to set, that he made also almost no research. And one last thing I might add, the declarations of Mr. Scott have made the whole thing worse. I mean, he it's one thing to say, listen, I'm not a historian, I'm a director, and my job is to make a good movie. Perfectly fine thing to say. But to say, as he has, that there is no such thing as knowing what happened, that when a historian tried to correct him on a particular point, he says, were you there? No, then shut the fuck up, which is what he said. Right? Can you, the crassness, the vulgarity, and the arrogance to believe, I mean, you and I must know people who have devoted 40 years of their life to studying one subset of papers from one sub-character in the government, right? Like, the people have devoted their life to studying Cambaceres, to studying Roderer, to studying Davout, immersed themselves in every detail of their archive, studying every possible and available first-hand source. We know what happened. We do. We know a tremendous amount. This is one of the most well-researched and one of the eras with the most amount of primary and secondary sources. I mean, anybody who met Napoleon, who served him wine at one time at a dinner, left a memoir. We can corroborate the sources and we can check what's nonsense, what's propaganda. We know the political leanings of the people writing these sources. We have so much work done. We know what happened. So you want to make a good movie, and that's not accurate, that's fine. Make a good movie that's inaccurate. But then don't tell historians who are fourth generation deep into this stuff that there's no such thing as historical truth. That's what really grinds my gears.
Yeah, and I think that was a general consensus in our meetings as well. I think, someone said, Napoleon should have enough charisma to fry an egg on his forehead. I wouldn't have followed Joaquin Phoenix to the bus stop.
Exactly. That's such a good point, too. I mean, you watch Phoenix's portrayal and you wonder why, despite his short stature and not particularly good looks, he was able to seduce so many women. He was able to lead so many men to their deaths, even when he lost everything. He had nothing left to offer them. He still electrified people. I mean, people volunteered to follow him in St. Helena. I mean, this is a man who captivated his entire generation. Even people who hated him were captivated by him. So I really thought that this was a great opportunity. It was the great Hollywood budget. It was the great actor. It was the great director. They really could have made something great, man. They really could have. And they did not.
Well, maybe Steven Spielberg will get it right when he does his miniseries.
I'm hearing good things about the script. Obviously, what's the name of the great director? The Kubrick script.
Yes, the Kubrick
Denny script. Kubrick script. Yeah, I'm hearing good things. Fingers crossed. I think the TV show also is the medium which best lends itself to the story.
I would agree. A miniseries or a you know, 8 episodes, you know, an hour long, you know, kind of gives it a little bit more scope. One of my criticisms of the Ridley Scott film was that it was both too narrow and overambitious at the same time.
Yes.
It tried to tell too narrow a story, but it also tried to go over too long a time period. It needed to decide what it wanted to be, and I don't think it really could decide what it wanted to be. You know, is it the story of the whole period? Is it the story of Josephine and Napoleon? Because those are two separate things, and you know that it didn't really tell either of those stories very well.
Exactly, and it was so fast. I mean, I watched it for the second time in North Carolina with a buddy of mine who had to take a call. Mm-hmm. Walked out of the cinema 7 minutes, 6 minutes. Came back in. What I miss? I said, "Oh boy." Well, you missed his divorce, his second marriage, the birth of his son, and the start of the Russian campaign. So yeah, something like 5 years,
right? Yeah.
And you just said, "Oh my God!" Right? Like this is absolutely crazy.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I want to thank you for being with us today, and thank you for your time. We look forward to the publication of your book, and we appreciate you taking the time to be with us on the Napoleonic Quarterly today, and thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you. If I may just leave you and your followers with one lesson, which is the great lesson of the book, of course, is that we've all heard a friend or an acquaintance or a coworker say, I wish I could read more, but I simply don't have the time. Well, Napoleon Bonaparte, ruler, reformer, politician, war leader, led his armies in person, obsessed over every logistical detail of his troops, of his campaigns, of his government, the great man of action. If he could read and read extensively and read obsessively and still sleep 7 hours a night, you can too. Sandra from Human Resources, you can. Everybody can. So let that be a lesson. We can all read. One must treat reading in the same way one treats feeding or working out. It is simply non-negotiable. Right? It is something that you do. It is a condition sine qua non. Nothing else exists apart from that. I mean, it is the testimony that we give to the people who came before us and who left us these great works of literature. It absolutely must be done, whether it is for utility, as Napoleon certainly did, reading about law and war and philosophy, but also for pleasure, because by God, is there pleasure in reading. So that's the lesson that Napoleon leaves to all of us.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to thank you again for your time today. And listeners, we hope that you'll be back with us soon. I want to send my own personal well wishes out to Charles Esdale as he continues to recuperate, and we hope to have him back on the podcast soon. And I want to thank Alex and all the folks involved in the Napoleonic Quarterly for giving me the opportunity to be here today. And again, thank you, Mr. Sarkozy, for being with us today. I hope you all have a great time.
Thank you again. Yeah.